This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, colleagues and friends. I welcome you to the National Museum of Australia, and in doing so, acknowledge the Indigenous people on whose land this museum stands. My name is Peter Stanley. I'm from the museum's Centre for Historical Research, and it's been my pleasure to have worked with Guy Hansen and our colleagues in public events to organise this symposium. And we're very pleased to see so many people here as participants. I should explain why we're gathering under the rubric of a collections symposium. The National Museum now has a tradition of holding such gatherings to explore the origins and nature of its collections, their care and use, and the potential they offer to understand the human story of this continent and nation. And this year's theme, Objects as Sources, is of special interest to the museum's new Centre for Historical Research. Because we're part of a museum, the Centre has a very strong interest in material culture, and its members, the Centre's members, are embarking on a collaborative research project called, for convenience, Material Histories. And that project seeks to use material culture as a source of evidence about the past. At the same time, our curatorial colleagues have complementary interests in using objects to understand and interpret historical themes. So this symposium came about, jointly organised by Guy Hansen and myself, and including speakers from our respective parts of the museum. We believe that this issue would be of interest more broadly, and the fact that this theatre will be, in the course of the day, filled to capacity confirms our view. Well, let's move straight into the first session. Now, in structuring this symposium, we were conscious that we weren't inventing this topic. We weren't addressing it for the first time. There are various established approaches to using material culture which emerge from relevant disciplines. So we thought it would serve us well to be reminded of those traditions and approaches at the very outset. Accordingly, we invited four speakers to set the scene, each speaking for 15 minutes, and with 5 minutes at the end of each presentation for discussion, and with time for discussion at the end of the session. So first of all, it's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Mike Smith of the Centre and of the Museum. Mike is not only a distinguished deep-time archaeologist of humanity in the Australian desert, but he's also the intellectual godfather of the Centre for Historical Research, and he's been a great support to me in the Centre's first year. Mike will give the archaeologist's view. Thanks, Mike.
The quote here is from E. Evans Pritchard, one of the founders of British social anthropology. He said the material culture provided the chains along which social ideas run. And I guess part of our task in museums is to take those chains, the material culture, and see if we can work back to the ideas. Now, firstly, a caveat. I'm not a historian. I don't claim any particular expertise in material culture. I am one of the catalysts of today's symposium. And I think my role is really to beat a few bushes and to see what flies out so we can get perhaps the measure of what work historians have been doing in this area. But I want to suggest perhaps that natural history, archaeology, technology, ethnography and art history all have strong traditions of using specimens, artefacts or artworks as primary data, but that social history seems to have made little use of material culture in this way. There are some notable exceptions, of course, amongst Australian historians, and I'm thinking of Graeme Davidson, Philip Jones, Linda Young, and you'll see a range of papers today that all, in their own way, are exceptions to this statement. But many historians will walk past objects to reach the archival records, photographs and audio recordings, which seem to represent a richer vein of information about the past. And this is perhaps as much a matter of training and disciplinary orientation as opportunity. But I think the problem here is the lack of a strong and visible school of material culture research amongst museum-based historians leaves the potential of the nation's social and environmental history collections underdeveloped. Perhaps I'm wrong in all of this. But if so, part of the role of the symposium today will be, as I've said, to flush out existing work by historians in this area, perhaps to develop an intellectual map of what has been done, what's been tried, and what's worked, as well as to stimulate new work in this area. Well, more than 30 years ago, just returning to my own field, archaeology. In his book, Behavioural Archaeology, Michael Schiffer argued that we should look at the flow of objects in and out of their systemic contexts, the way new values are ascribed to objects, and the sorts of transformations in function and context this entailed. And you can see his sort of flow model here. I mean, his book was a sort of tenure-track, try-hard sort of book. But it's an interesting model here, looking at the acquisition of raw materials, the way manufacture and design plays into this, the way artefacts are used and discarded and recycled and repurposed and end up as refuse, and what happens to them after they end up as refuse. And in the museum context, of course, objects may cycle through social systems and then end up in a museum for a spell, which in a way is an analogue to falling out of systemic context. They get new values, different sorts of values, or they may be dead to the normal canons of circulation of material. While reconstructing artefact biographies and behavioural chains and following an artefact from cradle to grave has now become core business in prehistoric archaeology and has been for more than 20 years. Shifting to anthropology or cultural studies, a decade after Schiffer, Apadurai wrote The Social Life of Things, quite a celebrated volume. Again, looking at the circulation of objects as commodities and the social transactions this involves. And it was a book that led to a range of other studies. Lubar and Kingery, Fred Myers' book, The Empire of Things, Regimes of Value and Material Culture. Journals such as the Journal of Material Culture or Material History Review reflected the growing interest in material culture, but also its move from simply ethnographic or cross-cultural material to including material culture from metropolitan Europe and North America. There was a parallel stream, of course, in cultural geography, particularly in the US, and I'm thinking here of Terry Jordan's wonderful book on the material culture of cattle ranching in North America and how the material culture gave quite a different picture of the origins of ranching than the straight documentary records. And more recently, there's been a string of publications by the School of Material Culture Research at University College London, led by Danny Miller, which include the recently published Handbook of Material Culture and his book in 2001, Home Possessions, Material Culture Behind Closed Doors. Now, most of these works are by social scientists rather than historians. And as anthropology has sought to reposition itself and reclaim some relevance in the post-colonial era, it has energetically exploited its tradition of ethnographic research to colonise the margins of history, moving into studies of materiality and contemporary society. And in museums, they find a liminal space that's poorly occupied by museum historians, with the exception of some polymaths like Philip Jones, whose wonderful book, Ochre and Rust, shows some of the possibilities of using objects to write new sorts of histories, in this case, histories of the Australian frontier. Historians may well approach material culture in a very different way from social scientists and anthropologists, with different questions in mind and perhaps with not so much heavy theorising. Nonetheless, it's surprising to see that there's been so little apparent interdisciplinary traffic between history and this body of material cultural work. Now, I don't wish to be too hard on museum curators and museum historians here. Anyone who works in museums will know there's a lot more going on behind the scenes, and the journal literature suggests there are some really innovative approaches to exhibitions developing, and some of this finds its way into published catalogues, exhibition catalogues, but largely it's a body of work that's hard to discover, and only a fraction of it gets published. What can we do with objects? I'd suggest perhaps there are three complementary lines of research, each giving a different weight to objects as sources of information. There's the classic object provenance type research, developing and exploring the histories around an object. And this may simply explore the association between an object and a person, Governor Macquarie's sword, or an event. Or it may be quite a sophisticated, nuanced exploration of the multiple histories in which objects are embedded, treating an object as the nexus of many different sorts of histories, histories of technology and manufacturing, of instrument makers, of science, of social milieu, of individual lives and events. At the next level of research, objects can also serve as aids to discovery, pointing to silences or gaps in scholarship, material reminders of forgotten histories. As Philip has used some of the objects in his book Ochre and Rust. But in many cases, these forgotten histories are then explored or pursued through the documentary records. The material objects serve just as pointers to directions that have been ignored or overlooked. A third and more difficult level is where we use objects or cultural assemblages of objects as primary historical sources, objects as data, recording information not contained in the documentary record. And some examples might include using several generations of Papunya Chula paintings to explore the dynamics of an art tradition, using colonial clothing to look at the biometrics of populations in Australia, stuff that often doesn't make it into the record of the time, using the distribution of 19th century ceramics to explore the global reach of European commerce, or perhaps using material culture to explore the dynamics over time of class or ethnicity in Australian towns, as the archaeologists are doing here at the old town of Kyandra in the High Country. The best of material culture research probably includes all three lines of research, and there's obviously a dialogue between these, and good material culture research is probably an iterative process where you move backwards and forwards between these levels of research. But let's just quickly look at what objects might be able to tell us. Starting with object biographies, a close reading of objects can reveal aspects of the design and manufacture, their use lives and eventual discard that perhaps won't be recorded or will be poorly recorded in a documentary record. I've just picked out a few illustrative examples. Skeuomorphs, one of my favourite words. Many objects bear decorative elements that mimic other materials, often reflecting the history of these objects. Ceramics have designs that reflect their origin in basketry. One-piece moulded plastic sandals mimic woven leather strips. Penknives have plastic bone handles. And these records say the retention of these features say something about the status and value of an object and how we think an object should look. Then there's the use life of objects, how an object is used, recycled, curated, and discarded, and what happens after it is discarded. And some wonderful studies by materials analysis in this sort of area. I'm thinking of David Hallam's work on the Leichhardt plate, not only trying to authenticate this plate, but also looking at the actual history of a small metal plaque that was once attached to a firearm and was found in the desert and is possibly the remains of the lost Leichhardt expedition. I mean, this is a forensic area with lots of possibilities for collaboration across the fields. There's a very fine paper by Kitty Hauser in the Journal of Material Culture looking at a garment in the dock, how the FBI illuminated the prehistory of a pair of denim jeans, which looks at the very individual wear patterns encoded in a pair of jeans, in this case used in a bank robbery. And then there's repurposing, artefacts that are really made for one purpose but are widely used for another purpose. And the traces of use bear witness to this. Seed grinding dishes used to sharpen stone axes, 4-inch builder's trowels that become the iconic tool of archaeologists. Moving beyond the physical analysis of objects, we can also look at the social worlds in which objects circulate. There's an obvious role here in display and prestige and colonial uniforms and the decoration on them. There's also the changing values. Some objects record rather marked changes in values. I'm thinking here of what Alan Atkinson points out as having been deep shifts in an ocean of feeling. Maybe the position of animals in society or our attitude towards them, or changing views on whether we're a set of colonies or a nation. And the global circulation of goods. Not just the move of items from ethnographic context into metropolitan museums and all the transactions that are involved in that, but also the way, in this case, blue and white transfer wear from British manufacturing centres arrives in the Orkneys, on the Namib coast, and at Port Essington in northern Australia, all more or less at the same time and within a few years of its manufacture, saying something about the isolation or not of this military garrison in northern Australia. And, of course, assemblages of objects can say something about identity, the extent of social and economic differentiation. They can express race, gender, marital status, ethnicity or class. And the historical archaeologists have played around quite a lot with this. But it's been a very interesting project by Peter Menzel for the United Nations Population Fund, an attempt to capture through photographs and statistics the great differences in material goods and circumstances between rich and poor societies. And interactions. Moving beyond the worlds in which objects circulate, we can also look at social worlds that are partly constructed by objects. Encounter and exchange is one area. Some objects nicely record cross-cultural exchange, and there are wonderful examples in Philip Jones's book Ochre and Rust, which I'm a big fan of. But my example here is the Herero long dress worn by married Herero women in Namibia. It's modelled on the Victorian dresses worn by the wives of German missionaries in the 1850s. Its five petticoats that are worn with it create a swaying walk, a pregnant appearance, and the headdress mimics cattle horns. And these are all references to the importance of cattle in Herero society. But the adoption by the Herero of this Victorian mode of dress is also a way of somehow capturing the power of the German colonial authorities. It's a very interesting material statement of a colonial encounter and exchange. New behaviours. People actively co-opt new technology to their own ends. New objects can create new patterns of behaviour and social life. Graham Davidson's Car Wars, How the Car Won Our Hearts and Conquered Our Cities, is a good example. It's sometimes been asked, do cars create drivers? As an editor, I would shake my head and say, no, put a red pen through that, this is sophistry. But there is an important point here. People respond to the car as more than just a means of transport, and it starts to restructure lives. And then there's collecting, the behaviour that we're involved in here. Schiffer's last stage, as objects leave the systemic context to become buried in archaeological sites. There's an analogue here to the way social history objects circulate as consumer items, then as collectibles, before coming to rest in museums, with all the same questions of what survives and why, and the role of museums in actively creating new values for some objects. Is Farlap of real historical value or just another dead racehorse? Have museums manufactured an icon or perhaps a religious relic here? There's plenty of scope for museums to examine their own role in the social life of things and the regimes of value that surround objects. So just to sum up, I think there's a very rich field here for historians and museum historians in particular to plumb. Books by Jones and Davidson and other historians show some of the possibilities, but not all objects will have equal potential to provide fresh history, independent of written sources or oral history. In the 1980s, historical archaeologists in Australia worried about whether historical archaeology was simply an adjunct to the documentary record, to written sources, with a role limited to testing and verifying aspects of that documentary record. Or whether the archaeology records aspects of historical experience not contained in the documentary records. Sometimes the documentary records might reflect a public ideology, but the practice on the ground may be entirely different, and that's where the material culture can tell you what actually happened. So just to finish off dutifully, Danny Miller subtitled his book Material Cultures, Why Some Things Matter. The question for us as museum historians is, really, which things matter? Can we identify what sort of objects will reward this sort of analysis? What sorts of objects are likely to be rich sources of new historical information in their own right, and which are not? Thank you.
Can I pay tribute to what I see as Mike's synoptic grasp? It seems to me that he's an archaeologist that ranges from the Pleistocene to the present, and we're the beneficiaries of that. Next speaker, Guy Hansen, is senior curator in the Collection Development Unit here at the National Museum. He's worked as a history curator for over 17 years and has worked on a large number of collecting and exhibition projects. These include the museum's series of political cartooning exhibitions, Behind the Lines, the fabulous, captivating and curious exhibition, and most recently the outstandingly successful League of Legends 100 Years of Rugby League exhibition. Not surprisingly then, Guy will give a curator's view. Guy.
Thank you very much. Today I've been invited to respond to the question of how we can use material culture to inform our understanding of the past. That is, how can we use objects as evidence in constructing historical narratives? In reflecting on this question, I was reminded of sitting in a seminar room in the Tower Block of the University of Technology, Sydney, some 20 years ago, in a postgraduate public history course discussing the failings of historians. All too often, the criticism went, historians come to objects and images after they've completed their work. Rather than seeing material culture as evidence, objects are reduced to providing a nice illustration to complement an already completed text. Dana Kavanagh's article, Objects as Evidence, published in 1989, I most probably read it when I was at UTS, neatly summarised this ambivalent relationship that historians have to using objects as evidence. As she described it, for some historians and curators, objects have become, at very best, a useful as illustration to a storyline drawn from other sources, and at worst, a drain on resources and energy. At the time that Kavanagh wrote these words, I think there was a strong parallel between the emerging interest in material history and oral history. Both areas were seen as new sources of evidence which could provide an insight into histories otherwise hidden. To briefly rehearse the argument of the time, history as a discipline, because of its reliance on documentary evidence, inevitably privileges political elites. Oral and material sources, in contrast, offer the chance to reveal new histories of social groups previously ignored. Material culture as such was seen as another important part in the larger historical project of history from below or social history. So, have things changed in the last 20 years? Has the early enthusiasm of social historians for exploring new sources of evidence led to the telling of new object-based histories? For some commentators, the answer is no, as we've just heard from Mike. Recently, Mike, in a review, commented that, with a few notable exceptions, the objects in social history exhibitions are subordinate to histories dependent on documents or oral records. They tend to be used to illustrate or anchor a theme or narrative. Rarely, if ever, are objects allowed to shape their historical narrative in novel ways, using the object itself to expose gaps or silences in other records. Reading Mike's words, I was forced to reflect on whether things really had changed so little in the last two decades. I'm happy to say I'm not quite as pessimistic about the failure of history curators to use objects as evidence. I want to argue today that there are an increasing number of object-centred histories and history exhibitions being produced in Australia. I also want to argue that there are very good reasons why objects can be problematic as a source of evidence, and that in order to utilise them as a primary source, you need to proceed with caution. Finally, I'd like to talk about the symbolic power of objects and how this impacts on their use as evidence. To bring the paper to a close, I'll look at the example of the Winfield Cup, an object I used recently in the League of Legends exhibition. Firstly, let me turn briefly to the use of material culture as evidence in Australian history. While not a large literature, there have been a number of major works which have utilised material culture in constructing a narrative about the past. Perhaps one of the best and most influential is Ken Inglis's Sacred Places, War Memorials in the Australian Landscape. This work, with its detailed survey of Australian war memorials, works its way from the material reality of many monuments scattered across the Australian landscape to the larger themes of the Anzac tradition and Australia's memory of war. Graham Davison's Car Wars, already mentioned, explores the development of post-World War II Australia through the windscreen of the family car. As Graham says in the opening lines of his book, the history of our times is written not only in words but things. Another recent book, which is strongly object-centred, is Elizabeth Kwan's Flag and Nation, which makes extensive use of ephemera, objects and illustrations as evidence in compiling her definitive history of the Australian flag. The most recent example which demonstrates how objects can be used as a focal point for exploring the past is Philip Jones' Ochre and Rust, and Mike's already touched on that in his paper. Obviously a fantastic book. In addition to what might be thought of as object-centred histories, there's also been an increasing interest in the history of collections and collectors. Tom Griffith's Hunters and Collectors, The Antiquarian Imagination in Australia, published in 1996, is the classic example of this work in the Australian context. And more recently, Libby Robin has explored the history of national collections in her book on How a Continent Created a Nation. Turning now to the history of curatorship, I think there has been an even greater acceptance of material culture as an inspiration for historical narratives. This has been expressed in numerous exhibitions dealing with working life and popular culture. In the major history museums around the country, there has been a definite trend towards telling histories using material culture. The Powerhouse Museum in Sydney, and an early innovator in this area, has produced a number of major exhibitions over the last 20 years using objects as their primary source material for constructing historical narratives. One of my personal favourites is an exhibition entitled Refreshing Art of the Pub Wall, which was done in the late 1980s, which focused on the glass paintings, which were very much part of the Sydney pub scene in the 1950s and 60s. Curator Charles Pickett explored the history of this unique art form, working out from the paintings to provide a broader social history of Sydney pubs. Other topics covered by the Powerhouse have included the history of car culture, suburbia and Australian popular music, all using objects to a large extent as the source for their historical narrative. Drawing from the National Museum's recent list of exhibitions, I'd cite the Captivating and Curious exhibition, which explored the history of the National Museum's collections. Objects were displayed in terms of how they were collected, with background information provided about the original collectors. In the museum's permanent galleries, there have been a number of areas where material culture is the centre of storytelling. In the Eternity Gallery, objects are combined with other primary source material to explore people's individual stories. And in the Nation Gallery, objects are interrogated for their symbolic meaning, again moving out from the object to broader historical themes. More recently, the Papunya Painting Exhibition explored the history of Western desert art by focusing on the meaning of individual pieces. The labels for each artwork provided a matrix of information, including artist details, symbolism employed, and stories of country. I mention these exhibitions and books to demonstrate that there has been a growing engagement in the use of material culture in constructing histories. The last 20 years has seen a large volume of work also emerge from the heritage industry and the history of the built environment, which also turns to the material world to make arguments about the past. These streams of work suggest to me that there has been a significant change in the attitude of the history profession to material culture in the last 20 years. While there have been many examples of object-centred exhibitions, it's also true to say that many others continue in the older didactic tradition where the object selection is subordinate to a larger narrative. For my part, I'd have to say it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not unusual for curators to move from an established storyline to searching for objects. Indeed, in many cases, it's almost inevitable that you work in this way. The important thing in this context is that objects are selected because they're relative to the narrative being produced. Let me illustrate this point with a counterexample. A common trap for curators is to select objects because they have an association with a famous historical personality. This association may have nothing to do with the historical theme being explored. For example, in the National Museum's collection, there is Captain Cook's teacup. This object provides an insight into Cook's domestic setting and helps to humanise him. It also, as an object, reflects the conspicuous consumption of tea in the 18th century and the growth of porcelain as a mass-produced item. The object does not, however, assist in understanding Cook's achievements as a navigator. The temptation is always there to display material which is linked to a famous individual. Using objects in constructing an historical narrative should first pass the test of whether these objects are relevant to the story being told. An object's association with a famous personage, while significantly increasing its value at auction, does not necessarily increase its significance as a source of evidence. Returning then to the question of why aren't there more object-centred exhibitions? To answer this, I think it's worth pausing to consider some of the problems of using material culture as evidence. First and foremost is the issue of loss of contextual information about collections. For example, many of the anatomical collections of the National Museum, here you can see a slide of the old Institute of Anatomy, many of the anatomical collections of the National Museum of Australia were acquired by Colin McKenzie, the head of the Institute. And he acquired them as part of a larger research project on comparative anatomy. McKenzie did not keep detailed records showing the subspecies, the sector and location of origin of each specimen. Rather, the specimens were labelled with a brief description of the organ preserved and the common name of the animal. McKenzie's focus on the anatomical attributes of his specimens reduced their significance from a zoological perspective. The individual provenance of many specimens was lost. McKenzie's approach to collecting demonstrates how the circumstances surrounding the creation of a collection impacts on its potential use as evidence. Decorative art, natural science and technology museums all collect material with particular uses in mind. These various collecting paradigms impose a filter on the information recorded at the time of acquisition. The potential use of these collections as evidence is, in part, a function of these filters. If the individual provenance of an object is lost because the collector was only interested in the form and type of an object, a severe limit is placed on its evidentiary power. The constraints of how a collection was created can, in some circumstances, with considerable work, be overcome. With painstaking research, it is sometimes possible to recover the provenance of an object. Sometimes this is assisted through a forensic examination of the object, as in the case of the Leichhardt plate, but more often than not relies on documentary research. As one of my colleagues recently described it, it is akin to a process of triangulation, whereby in order to make an authoritative statement about the object, you need to corroborate or contextualise the object in relation to other sources. The meaning of the object is established through a matrix of information. Another problem of material culture evidence is the symbolic power of objects. By this I mean how an object can operate as a symbol separated from its individual provenance. For example, in the area of convict history, there is a considerable historiographical debate about the harshness of conditions for convicts. Much of the material evidence which survives the convict era reinforces the popular perception of convict servitude as a form of hell on earth. Objects such as cat of nine tails, manacles, leg irons and man traps, all of which commonly feature in convict history exhibitions, carry such symbolic weight that it is difficult to give a more nuanced account of convict life. I cannot help but suspect that the visual impact of these objects reinforces the more bloodthirsty narratives of convicts. I encountered this problem of the symbolic power of objects most recently in preparing the League of Legends exhibition. One of the key objects for this exhibition was the Winfield Cup, the 1980s Premiership Trophy for the New South Wales Rugby League. For rugby league fans, this trophy is instantly recognisable and is the focus of great nostalgia and affection. While the exhibition was on in Canberra, I had the opportunity to observe how visitors responded to this object. One fan summarised the significance of the trophy in an exit interview. "I loved the Winfield Cup, the story, trying to mutilate each other, then coming off as mates, like Australian mateship and camaraderie." This celebratory reading of the trophy, which I think is the popularly held interpretation of the object, stands in stark contrast to the event which inspired its creation. The trophy is based on a photograph taken in the aftermath of the Western Suburbs and St George Grand Final played on a rain-sodden Sydney cricket ground in 1963 by Herald Sun photographer John O'Grady. It depicts the victorious St George captain Norm Proven briefly embracing the defeated Western Suburbs captain Arthur Summons. Rather than the popularly perceived image of comradeship and respect associated with the image, the moment was one of high tension. Prior to the match, allegations were made that the referee had been bribed to ensure a St George victory. The Western Suburbs players were convinced that they'd been the victim of match fixing. Norm Proven recalls that immediately following the end of the game, he approached Summons to swap jerseys, a long-practised post-match tradition. This explains how Proven appears stripped to the waist, shoulder pads exposed like a gladiator's armour. Summons, deeply disappointed and harbouring the suspicion that the referee had manipulated the result, refused to part with his own jersey. In Summons' words, "He wanted to swap jumpers and I told him to get stuffed, and that St George not only beat us, but the referee was paid to do a job on us." The incongruity of the transformation of Proven and Summons' post-match encounter into a symbol of sportsmanship is not lost on former Western Suburbs players. Noel Kelly, the player who first spoke about the allegations of match-fixing, described the evolution of the image as a huge irony. Nevertheless, he considered that it is a great image, which, and I quote, "in its moment of shared mateship after a tough game, seems to capture just about everything that is good in the game of rugby league." Kelly's words neatly summarise how the power of the image overwhelms the specifics of the historical events that surrounded its creation. For me, the Winfield Cup is a good example of how material culture can generate conflicting historical narratives. Inherent within the object can reside a number of contradictory stories. At one level, the story of camaraderie and mateship, at another, match-fixing and corruption. These alternative histories demonstrate the complexity of using material culture as evidence. The type of narrative produced will be a function of the interpretive tools brought to bear. At one level, it is valid to say that the Winfield Cup symbolises sporting values widely held by the rugby league community. At another level, the Cup, after a process of deconstruction, can tell a much darker story about rugby league. I must say here that I've concentrated on the symbolic power of the trophy in this discussion of the Winfield Cup. There's much more to be revealed if we explore the significance of the Winfield brand and the importance of tobacco sponsorship in Australian sport, but that is the topic for another paper. Returning to the question posed at the beginning of my paper, have historians and curators started to seriously engage in material culture as a source of evidence? My answer is yes, though it may not have eventuated in quite the fashion envisaged by social historians in the 1980s. Institutions such as the Powerhouse, the Victorian Museum, the National Museum of Australia, and many others have produced many object-centred exhibitions. These have led to new histories exploring topics such as popular culture, working life, leisure and sport, largely ignored in some other areas of history discourse. Academic historians have also begun to actively engage in material culture as evidence. Curators and historians alike have discovered, like all sources of evidence, objects can be misleading. Objects clearly do not speak for themselves. They need the aid of a competent interpreter. Thank you.
Good morning. My name's Sam. I'm from the National Portrait Gallery. I just wondered whether you could respond to the idea that objects can mislead through collections without that interpretation. Could you speak to the idea that written histories perhaps also create obviously ambiguous and alternative histories through their translation?
Without doubt, and that's what I meant by my closing comments, that the status of material culture as evidence applies to other sources of evidence. No evidence is transparent and no evidence can be trusted. And that's I think the core of historical training is scepticism and bringing to bear analytical tools which helps you trying to say qualitatively better statements about the past. You're not necessarily saying the truth, but you're most probably saying a better, more nuanced, more sophisticated statement about the past. So what I say about... I think material history generates a particular set of problems, but there are, of course, problems associated with the interrogation of documents or oral history, which are incredibly significant as well.
Paula Hamilton from UTS. Thank you for a wonderfully instructive paper. I was just interested in the point you were making about the circumstances of collecting and how that shapes how an object can be evidence in the future. Would you argue now is that inevitable or you think it's inevitable?
Well, no, it's a very good point. And what it means, what it puts on us as, say, in the National Museum right now, is that we're saying, oh, isn't it frustrating that Mackenzie didn't record more information? But, of course, we're collecting material right now. And so the pressure on us now is to try and work out what information are we going to collect? What do we think is significant? And try and be upfront about our assumptions. I think we'll always fail to record things which the future may be interested in, but I think it's very important for us to be very clear about what our collecting assumptions are, state those, and try and collect as much information as possible at the point of acquisition. So it most probably is inevitable, but you can do a number of things to try and improve the situation.
Right. So it would still be... So people of the future will still say...
I suspect they will, yes.
Philip Jones, South Australian Museum. It is interesting. I find this is in relation to Mike's paper as well, which I enjoyed very much, that almost an inverse relationship between the discourse on objects and museums and the number of objects in exhibitions. The ratio... If you look back a century, and particularly the Institute of Anatomy photograph that you showed, you can see a certain, could you say, confidence by museums in particular in the ability or the capacity of objects to tell stories for the museum. Is there a relationship between the suspicion or the uncertainty that museums and possibly their upper echelons have in the capacity of objects to speak for themselves, an investment in the curatorial voice, which tends to weed out the objects, if you like, and as they're weeded out, suddenly there's space for the discourse to emerge.
That's a really good question. I think that the technique of mass display is one which is coming back and is seen. South Australian Museum, I see some examples, and also in the National Museum, we've, in a number of exhibitions, gone back to mass displays. I think there's some pragmatic reasons why mass displays don't occur as often, and that is the conservation and presentation requirements and design requirements. It can be exhausting to do a 1,000 object exhibition, where if you can do a 50 object exhibition, that's a little bit less work. And but I mean, I do think there is this playing out of people perhaps wanting to overinterpret single items as well as being and as well as how to present large numbers of items. And I that's sort of something which is I've been thinking about a lot myself, and I don't have an answer for. But I think you've picked up on a key interpretive technique type issue which curators have.
Mary Nugent from National Museum. I was interested that some of your examples have a strong kind of visual element. So thinking about the pub images and then and the Winfield Cup. And so just interested in reflections on the relationship between, you know, objects as evidence and objects with images as evidence.
I think one of the things which happens with curators is development of what you might call the curatorial eye. And I think that in objects which have visual power and presence are going to be the ones you try and use. And that is a combination of aesthetics and their underlying symbolism. And if you want to tell a powerful story, you will try and do those. There are many ubiquitous, mundane objects which are important historical evidence but don't get used because they're not particularly attractive. And and that, of course, does bias your accounts because obviously you'll go for pretty things. And that's something which you have to engage in and think about as a curator when you're doing that work.
Margaret Anderson. Margaret is the director of that unique and wonderful institution, the History Trusts of South Australia. She's well known as a teacher in our field, the author of Material Culture and the Cultural Environment, Objects and Places, and in a career spanning more than 30 years, she's worked in museums in Western Australia and South Australia and taught history and Australian studies at Monash University. And Margaret will offer an historian's perspective. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you to the National Museum for organising such an interesting presentation today. I was going to call this paper Getting Thingy About Australian History, and then I changed my mind. I thought that perhaps wasn't quite the tone that I should be setting. Now, we've heard a bit about the fact that advocates of material history often begin with two premises. The first is that historians have traditionally preferred written texts to material culture as historical evidence. And so when Stephen Lubar and David Kingery begin their edited volume, History from Things, they began with the observation, we are surrounded by things and we are surrounded by history, but too seldom do we use the artefacts that make up our environment to understand the past. The second premise is more an assertion, that studying history through objects suggests new insights and provokes new questions that, quote, mere documents cannot begin to approach. Jules David Proun argued that objects considered in this context reflect consciously or unconsciously, directly or indirectly, the beliefs of the individuals who commissioned, fabricated, purchased or used them, and by extension the beliefs of the larger society to which these individuals belonged. Now, this is an ambitious claim, particularly, I would suggest, when considered in the context of industrial capitalism. But it is fair to say that enthusiasts for material culture studies can tend towards the evangelical on occasion. Of necessity, perhaps, because there is no doubt that the study of what that doyen of American material culture, Thomas Schlereth, has called the totality of objects in a culture is a daunting task indeed. Perhaps the sheer scale of the undertaking is one reason why historians drawing literally on a lifetime of research have offered, to my mind, some of the most compelling reflections on material life. And I'm thinking here of people like Marc Bloch, Fernand Braudel, or Emmanuel Ladurie in France,
Asa Briggs, Michael Thompson in Britain, James Dietz, Henry Glassy, John Demos, Tom Schlereth himself in America, or Geoffrey Blainey, Rhys Isaac, and Graham Davison in Australia. Now, not all of these historians have been considered or would consider themselves material culturists, a term coined only partly seriously, I think, by Schlereth. Indeed, in Victorian Things, published in 1988, Asa Briggs really used the term material culture, and when he did, it was in inverted commas. You won't find it in his index. But that was his focus, nevertheless. And I was reminded once again while reading for this paper of the incredible scholarship he brought to bear on that study of things. And if you think this is an outrageous claim for the advantage of age and experience, you're right. In Australia, studies that locate themselves explicitly within material culture or material life are relatively thin on the ground, although, as we've heard this morning, thankfully, that may be changing. Some of the earliest work drew directly on museum collections, and I'm thinking here of Kimberly Webber's exemplary study of sewing machines in colonial Australia, Anne Delroy's work on gas stoves in Western Australia, Anne Stephen and Andrew Reeves' book on trade union banners. Later work at the Powerhouse we've heard a little bit about this morning too, extended beyond the collections to aspects of material life. Judith O'Callaghan's catalogue and exhibition on Australian design in the 50s. Charles Pickett's study of fibro housing are two examples. When I was at the Western Australian Museum, I managed one collaborative research project on national allegory and iconography. But I never got around to the book that topic deserves. Other museums, including the Museums of the History Trust, have found it difficult to sustain a commitment to long-term research projects alongside the relentless grind of exhibition production, although the research undertaken for some of those projects has real potential. And I'm thinking of one of the exhibitions at the Migration Museum, Strictly Black, and one of the long-term projects they have underway at present called Preserving Cultures, which looks at foodways and the creation of identity in immigrant communities. One of the main problems, though, for historians wishing to work with museum collections is the random nature of most of those collections. Historical collections have grown in a haphazard way, many in the shadow of natural history or the history of technology, and they don't always lend themselves easily to answering the more expansive questions about change in society that historians want to ask. Even questions framed with objects in mind, research into aspects of material life, for example, have generally sought most of their evidence in sources other than the things themselves. The sheer volume of material goods acquired and consumed in the past 200 years is part of that issue. And then, perhaps it is because I'm an historian, that I will always consider the ideas surrounding things as important as the things themselves. But notwithstanding those reservations about museum collections, I'd like to return to those initial questions about material culture as historical evidence and consider some of the recent work published in Australia in the light of two questions. Firstly, whether it identifies new research questions that have the potential to change the way we think about past societies. And secondly, whether the material evidence cited in these studies can support the weight of interpretation placed upon it. One of the most interesting research projects in recent years is the extended multidisciplinary inquiry into the history of inner city Melbourne's Little Lawn, and this is a not very good slide from a reconstruction in the new exhibition at the Museum of Melbourne. That densely settled area around Little Lonsdale Street that is now almost completely given over to high-rise office blocks, but once housed dozens of poor workers and their families. Both separately and in various combinations, Alan Main, Tim Murray and Susan Lawrence have reflected on their approach to this project, which essentially combined the research strengths of historical archaeology and documentary history analysis to bring what they called an integrated analytical framework to bear on an urban society and its embedded material culture. Maine also had a particular interest in interrogating past and present designations of the area as a slum. The trio introduced their article in Historical Studies in April 2000 in these terms. This paper integrates history and archaeology in order to reclaim the actualities of one city neighbourhood, Melbourne's Little Lawn, from the distorting realities fashioned by outside perception. But when it came to the material evidence, there was very little to go on. Indeed, the authors warned quite sternly against assuming any, quote, ready-made bridge of consciousness between past and present inherent in an object. We delude ourselves, they argued, if we pretend that the past is still there, hidden, preserved in things, awaiting our rediscovery. And yet, perhaps the desire to draw some conclusion from all that digging, sorting, classifying and describing triumphed in the end. In a former cesspit, the team came upon a veritable treasure trove of ceramic and glass shards and a number of Staffordshire figurines. These tracings from a poor household, they suggested, with their overtones of domesticity, fly in the face of slum stereotypes. Collaboration between archaeologists and historians can thus contradict the universalising axioms of slum myths. But these slum myths must be fragile indeed if a few pottery figurines and some broken crockery can overturn them. Were slum dwellers really so completely devoid of all domesticity that they couldn't even own a few cheap knick-knacks? In fact, we suspect from English sources that the poor were quite fond of pottery figurines, even when they appeared to outsiders to lack basic necessities. Indeed, the Staffordshire potteries turned such things out in their millions for what had become by the mid-19th century a truly mass market. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting here that we should dismiss all or even most of the findings of this most important project. But I do question the adequacy of the material evidence cited in this particular instance. Part of the problem stems from the partial nature of the evidence concerned. And I had similar reservations about some of the conclusions that Mark Staniforth drew from his analysis of shipwreck material in his recent study of consumption patterns in early colonial Australia. The difficulty with the material in both cases is that only the imperishable items survive for analysis. And in the case of Little Lon, they are, apart from the figurines, almost universally items associated with food and drink consumption. The very things, in other words, that everyone had to own. It may be significant that there was little apparent variation in the material traces to match the grades of housing, but we cannot know what other things these people owned. And crockery was by this time very cheap. The distinctions within Little Lon, if they existed, and we can be almost certain that they did, may well have resided in other possessions, in furniture, clothing, even bedding, or in other aspects entirely, in regular employment, in literacy or sobriety. In musing on this paper, I was reminded of the subtle grades in early 20th century Salford society, recalled so vividly in Robert Roberts' 1971 memoir, The Classic Slum, which some of you may have come across. Here, caste could turn on a polished front step, curtains at the window, or a daughter's unwed pregnancy. But there was definite currency in bric-a-brac. The more the better, Roberts wrote. We need to understand much more about what poverty meant in material terms in Australia. And looking elsewhere may help us to ask multiple questions of the meagre material we have to work with. In thinking about Little Lon, I was also reminded of Carol Shamus' fascinating study of the consuming society of early modern England and America, which warned specifically against assuming a linear progression of consumption in the past. Being poor and being a consumer, it turns out, were not mutually exclusive, she argued. Paradoxically, the individual who drank tea in a teacup, wore a printed cotton gown, or put linen on the bed could be the same person who ingested too few calories to work all day and lived in a one-room house. Now, it may seem odd that I'm citing a study of early modern England in a conversation about material life in 19th century Australia, but I think that some of the points Shamus makes have resonance for Little Lon. I also think that students of material culture need to read across regions and across time, perhaps more than in other fields of inquiry. And it's not that I'm suggesting there is some sort of universal human response to material goods that is independent of its cultural context. Far from it. It's just that in seeking out the small things forgotten, as James Dietz has put it, we need all the insights we can get. Now, I was going to talk a little bit about one of the objects that Philip Jones talks about in Ochre and Rust, but I realise that I don't have time to do that, so perhaps it's best to try and explore that in conversations during the day, particularly as Philip is here. But the object that I was going to discuss was Master Blackburn's whip, and I'd be more than happy to do that in questions or in conversation with Philip later on. But by now you've probably decided that despite all my years in museums, I'm a closet old school historian who prefers documents to things. Not at all. I've argued quite as passionately as any that historians should take objects seriously and that material life is a worthy field of inquiry. But, and it's a big but, we need to subject the artefacts to the same kinds of scrutiny we apply to documents or pictures or photographs before we use them as evidence. The mere fact of their existence is not sufficient. And we need to understand what I might call the curatorial context. Perhaps connoisseurship is a better term. If, for argument's sake, we want to use costume or ceramics or furniture to support an argument about status symbols or respectability within a particular cultural context, we need some specialist knowledge of the material we're dealing with. And sometimes that can be a big ask. It takes a long time to acquire specialist knowledge, and historians and museums manage a bewildering array of objects. But this detailed knowledge can occasionally suggest that we ask alternative questions, provoking multiple readings. I only know Jane Elliott's work from an interesting article she published in Historical Studies in 1995. The title is intriguing enough, posed as a question: was there a colonial dandy? Subtitle, of course, convict consumer interests in Sydney, 1788 to 1815. The substance of the argument, for those of you who haven't read it, is that the people of Sydney, convict and ex-convict, male and female, were enthusiastic consumers and were notably fond of dress. Unlike their counterparts in England, they purchased clothing often, and purchased new clothing, moreover, rather than second-hand. This fine dress allowed them to look the part of their betters, even if they couldn't mix with them. It's a beguiling argument, and Elliot paints a vivid picture of avid consumers of haberdashery. But I find myself wondering if she'd considered two other possible explanations, admittedly much more prosaic, for this apparently high level of clothing consumption: Sydney's climate, and the fact that clothing at this time didn't necessarily wash very successfully. Dyes in the pretty printed materials often ran in the wash, and fabrics weren't always pre-shrunk. One of the most common requests from newly arrived settlers in letters home, even much later in the century, was for clothing and material that would wash successfully. Now, I'll leave it to your imagination to think about the state of clothing worn for extended periods through a Sydney summer. I know that standards of hygiene were different in the early 19th century, but I expect there were limits even then. And then there is the question of status and display. Sydney's ex-convicts may well have been pleased with their splendid new clothing, but such pretensions were cruelly ridiculed elsewhere. Victoria's goldfields saw many newly wealthy diggers descending on Melbourne to deck themselves out like ladies and gentlemen. Cartoonists lampooned them mercilessly. To close, I questioned at the beginning whether artefacts could sometimes suggest interesting, even contradictory readings of ideas and events. Let me pose one question from my own work as an historian and a curator, although I confess that I don't have an answer. One of the conundrums that has struck me over the years is a dissonance between women's increasing independence in the closing decades of the 19th century and the styles of clothing they wore. Far from matching women's freedom, women's clothing became increasingly restrictive. Bodies which were relatively lightly clothed in the early century were increasingly bound and confined. Corsets became longer and more heavily boned. Indeed, steel increasingly replaced whalebone in corsets. But the 1870s, ironically, just as women began to enter education and the professions, their skirts drew more tightly around their bodies, and bodices began to be boned as well, so that they were doubly encased. By the time women began to be enfranchised, even their collars were boned. And feminists were just as confined as other women. Only a tiny lunatic fringe ever adopted the so-called rational dress. Here is a photograph of Rose Scott and the Women's Political and Educational League in 1903, all addressed in the prevailing fashion of the time. Now, I've never found a satisfactory explanation for the complex forces at work here, although I suspect that psychologists would have a field day with it. Perhaps for now, I should merely repeat Carol Shammer's caution against the alluring fictions of linearity. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret, for a wonderful paper, and not just because you had such kind things to say about the benefits of age and experience. I wanted really to pick up a word in your last sentence, which was the word linearity. And it does seem to me that in much of the discussion that we have about how objects inform the past, there remains a kind of assumption that in the last resort we have to feed objects back into arguments which assume the traditional forms of the journal article or the linear narrative. And yet we're living in through a period when it seems to me narrative itself is now so problematised in all sorts of ways that we historians who still operate in that context often find ourselves looking for ways of expressing ourselves that are quite different and that in some ways are better modelled on the hypertext and the web and the kind of random walk of the museum than they are on traditional forms of expression. And that's why I suppose when Guy, in his presentation, asked the question, how can objects inform the writing of narrative, I'm inclined to question, at least to pause, and to ask whether or not we don't need to ask the question, as you did, I think in a slightly broader way, which is to ask, how do objects inform our understandings of the past? Because I think it may well lead us into thinking about different forms of expression, as well as into the most imaginative ways in which we can draw upon not just objects, but everything around us that helps us to understand the past. Sorry, that's a comment, isn't it, rather than a question, but would you like to respond to that?
It's a very nice comment. And I think probably one of the things that museums can do to try and facilitate that sort of, can we call it a dialogue, or is that another form of narrative? I don't know, but Web 2, it seems to me, which I'm only beginning to understand. I have very limited technical expertise in these things, but I know that there's a great deal of activity that goes on in the web, combining all sorts of information from all sorts of areas, including pictures, and that the users of our museums put material out there which we have absolutely no knowledge of and no control over and probably shouldn't seek to have any. And so people can curate their own exhibitions, if you like, online and post them up, and they do. And maybe this is one of the ways in which we can put some of this information, what can we call it, some of the material up there and just allow people to explore the ideas that it suggests to them and to bring different insights to bear on it. I think that's particularly important. So a very nice comment.
Thank you for your paper, Margaret. Richard Gillespie, Museum Victoria. I think you're right to inject a note of caution in discussing Little Lon to caution about the notion that you can just reconstruct the sense of a community out of the material culture of the domestic items left behind. I think that's something at Melbourne Museum in doing the exhibition that has the recreation of Little Lon we're very conscious of, and I think it's something that Tim Murray and Alan Main, as the historians and archaeologists who've worked on that site so much, have been very aware of as well. So, you know, the sorts of other sources that have been integrated as well as the material culture have been the rate books, Sister Esther, the missionary sister to the lanes and alleyways, her day book, oral histories that have been done of people who were children there in the early 20th century, sort of looking back. So there's a number of ways in which that history of Little Lon has been reconstructed other than just the material culture. And while you were talking, I think in some ways it's less that we're trying to... I mean, partly what we're doing is historicising that material culture. But I suppose the other thing we're doing for people is trying to materialise history. And so it's about finding other forms of historical practice other than text-based forms that are about reconstructing things and allowing people to kind of put their bodies in and imagine that space in a highly constructed way, granted, but nevertheless a kind of what can be a very powerful form of communication for people. And I wonder if sometimes our discussion gets caught up in using academic history as the kind of the benchmark by which we judge things. And I've been guilty of making that same comment and making those assumptions myself, and that what we need to do is look at a variety of historical practices and to measure what we do in terms of the kinds of audiences that we're trying to reach with that particular historical practice.
Sure. There's a lot of points in there, Richard, which I'll address extremely briefly, Peter tells me. In the first place, they certainly did use lots of different interpretations and different methods. It's just that in that particular instance, I think they were overwhelmed by the opportunity presented by material, without necessarily going into the history of that material in as much detail as they might have. Now, I don't know whether that's the case or not, but it certainly seemed that way to me. The reconstruction in the Melbourne Museum, I think, is fabulous, and I think that you do make those points, as do they. My caution, though, is that sometimes we can just be overwhelmed by the desire to make something of material that won't necessarily bear the interpretation. And I think that when we put an argument out there in an academic paper, as this was, then it's quite legitimate to subject it to academic analysis. The museum, perhaps, can do different things.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Again, Margaret, continuing that synoptic grasp, which is so important for us to understand the basis of this discussion. And Margaret, I think reflecting many of the questions and ambiguities that I certainly feel in thinking about this issue. It's my great pleasure now to introduce Fred Myers, who's probably responsible for attracting a good many of you here today. Fred is Silver Professor and Chair of Anthropology at New York University, and Mike's already mentioned Fred's book, The Empire of Things. He's also the author of Painting Culture, The Making of an Aboriginal High Art. And that goes back to Fred's work working with the Pintupi-speaking people in 1973, and he's interested in the new formations of the production and circulation of art and culture, and he's a very welcome visitor today. Fred's come from so far away that we've given him a few minutes extra, which will still give us 5 minutes at the end of his paper and 10 minutes at the end of the session. So there'll be great opportunity to interrogate Fred about the ideas he'll present, and we welcome him to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you. It's almost exactly 35 years since I first came to Canberra to begin research in Australia, and Canberra's been kind of second home to me, so I'm very happy to be here. It is a pleasure. It wasn't anything like this when I came before. When I was invited to speak at this symposium, I was curating a small exhibition at the Kluge Roux Collection of Aboriginal Art at the University of Virginia. I thought some of the paintings we selected for the show, works from Papunya Tula artists, would provide interesting examples of material sources of objects as sources of interpretation, at least as a starting point. I'm going to actually do something which I've never done, which is to some extent throw away some of my paper. I think a lot of things that I might have said have been also covered by people, but also paper is too long. I would, in the interest of bearing some witness to some other points, I think I'll probably try to spin it a little bit in that way. If you could do that. But partially what I want to do is talk about, in the broad perspective, a little bit about clashing perspectives and authority, if I can get to that. So, the first painting was a painting in this exhibition that I was dealing with, typically entitled in the collector's files and as Old Man Dreaming at Umari, 1973. It has been reproduced under that title and attribution since 1988 in the Asia Society Dreamings catalog and later sold to the current owner with that attribution. A couple of years ago, however, it was published in Barden and Barden's Papunya, a place made after the story, the big, I mean very big, compilation of Jeffrey Barden's drawings, photographs, and notes from the years when he advised Papunya Tula during its beginning. The painting, on an even piece of hard surface, unevenly cut, which already suggests a date for the painting, the surface material, was attributed by Barden to Shorty Longerda and said to be entitled Spirit Traveling Dreaming. The notes accompanying the image in this book, however, do not appear to be from Barden's original drawings at the time. That's a dimension of the materiality of the reproduction itself, in which you can see that the drawing is not from his original notebooks, but was produced at some later time. We do know a little bit about the subsequent history of this painting. In the Dreamings catalog, the painting is listed as having come from a private collection, and we also know that it was exhibited in a solo exhibition at the Seaview Winery in South Australia in 1973. We do not know where or when exactly it acquired its current identification. Without deciding definitively, although I do have a view, let me just note that the painting seems to bear some resonance with a later painting of the Old Man Dreaming, which I know is that since I collected it myself, documented in 1979. the reasons that we think it has some similarity is this kind of slightly tilted cross dimension seems to be reproduced in both of those. It's been very difficult to source the information very clearly, but I think that the absence of a drawing from the initial period suggests that Barden, in producing this, was relying on his memory and not any actual strong documentation. The other immediate puzzle was one entitled of a painting that was entitled. That's what Umari Rockhole looks like, which is painted there. I've had to black some of this out. The paint called Grasshopper Dreaming, painted by Utu Tajangala in 1972. I've modified the image with those black semicircles in the interest of respecting concerns about revelation. But I never heard any dreaming, and that is any mythological story, identified in this way, although I spent a lot of time with the painter. And it seemed to me that this was a mishearing, although reproduced in a very materially impressive book. In this painting, Barden recorded the story as the grasshopper, quote, traveling and looking for grass seeds, the traveling indicated by the series of straight lines with dot clusters and by the tracks made by the insect. The ceremonial men of the painting are inside their whirlies, branch shelters, indicated by a short curved line almost enclosed by a longer curved line. Ceremonial objects, a ground painting, and a ceremonial stick are shown, all of which are marked. The identification of this object with the grasshopper dreaming is probably an overspecification, identifying the overall story with a part of it, as the painting resembles several examples of Utu's paintings of Munapalango, the hill and clay pan site associated with his own conception dreaming. This is a painting I collected that belongs to the National Museum's collection here, Munapalango. If you'll notice, just to take a look at this, object on the right, which very similar to the object on the right in the painting here, slightly tilted, as is his wont. Objects along that long thing there are part of a ceremonial structure. This is a clay pan, and which is almost certainly is understood by Pintobi as having been made by ceremonial objects and is hiding them. Here the story by Mututu himself is identified with the two women, Minmakutara, and his ancestral being who was with them, who was known as Short Legs or Chontamortu, and who was frightened by the approach of the dangerous and powerful old man. Chontamortu, frightened by this approach, climbed into a cave, throwing out all the sacred objects inside of it, some of which became the hill known as Wintalga that lies behind a series of clay pans. That's the hill, is this long oblong object. In these clay pans, the seed Mungilpa grows abundantly after rains. The circles that depict the clay pans also depict the seed cakes made from Mungilpa, and the grasshoppers are no doubt attracted to this food source. The painting, therefore, would be an early version of a story represented in several other images over the years, and interestingly comparable. The amassing of an archive, either of images or of objects, allows us then to explore the development and choices of a painter, and in turn to understand better and to evaluate particular paintings such as this one. I think in the absence of an archive or a collection, we have very limited understanding of what these painters have done, however much we might know about from our own field work. These examples give some sense of the puzzle presented by the early Papunya paintings, the nearly 1,000 extraordinary paintings executed in the first year or so, 1971 to 72, a period at Papunya about which we have sometimes spotty and uneven knowledge. Here lies the intrigue of the archive and the collection for those trying to understand the intentions, ideas, specificities behind the images of what these indigenous men were doing in putting marks on the newly introduced two-dimensional surface. There can be a question of authorship, for example, as there was in the first paintings, the later painting of Norapalango again. The information and qualities of the image itself may raise issues of their historical provenance and who documented them, the credibility of the documentation and the documenter, him or herself, as part of the history of the objects, illuminating the relationships in which objects are embedded and circulated. So I don't have, in this case, an interest simply in specifying the image itself, but also in understanding the network of relationships in which this information is produced wrongly or rightly as part of the broad phenomenon that is this art form. For Papunya Tula, these examples, and there are many like this, show the kinds of knowledge those who documented them had, or even the struggles or conflicts between Jeff Barden, the first art advisor, and Pat Hogan, the sympathetic gallerist in Alice Springs and sometimes advisor and staunch competitor with Jeff Barden for authority over the paintings. But for other paintings, we might be interested if we want to know about the making of Aboriginal high art through its uptake into cosmopolitan art worlds. In what exhibitions particular paintings were exhibited? How did Grasshopper Dreaming or Old Man find its way into the market? Was this one of the exhibitions that Bob Edwards, director of the Aboriginal Arts Board of the Australia Council, organized? Was it tied to someone else's connections to a winery? These are vital questions in understanding a multi-sided story of the development of Indigenous painting in Australia. In terms of a broader anthropological theorizing, these dimensions of an object's biography and materiality are especially interesting, as anthropology's interest in the object has expanded from understanding and documenting its place in a local system to engaging with the fuller biography, the fuller context of a situation in which objects are also embedded in intercultural processes of circulation, curiosity, nostalgia, and imagined new relationships. These are part of what anthropologists would now regard as the materiality of objects, how they got where they are, what relationships they mark out. The process of collecting itself is of great interest to anthropologists, and I'm very happy to note that Philip Jones is here, who I think wrote one of the great papers about this on the collection of Chiringas in the late 19th century. But we see the objects of a collection not just as illustrative or representative of a culture which had historically been the framework in which anthropologists engaged with objects, not as static and freestanding, but as actual historic moments indicating the interest in objects at a time, the connections between cultures, and the processes of their selection. Now, I'm going to just freewheel it because I had too much to write, but I just want to point out, most of you are probably not anthropologists, so I want to just make a very brief mention of the history of anthropology and objects. Principally, anthropology was born in museums in the 19th century, which were object-centered. Most of the work was of exhibition around these objects was about producing knowledge, narratives, and stories in which people in the West, who were the collectors of these objects, could understand themselves and their relationships to these new formations outside. The principal exhibitionary frameworks involved unilineal evolution from primitive to civilized, which became fundamentally the subject of anthropology's own critique. That is, the 19th century anthropology was the object of criticism of the 20th century anthropology based more in fieldwork. But along with that criticism and with the anthropological movement to fieldwork came, especially with social anthropology, a considerable neglect of objects altogether in favor of people's stories, what they could say, and not anything like the same kind of attention. Nonetheless, exhibitions obviously continued. But we know that by, and I'm going to shift very much forward, that the 1970s were a period, which will be familiar to all of you, I think, in which frameworks of critique like primitivism and orientalism rose to the surface in a number of relationships to a number of important exhibitions that had their roots in broad changes. So I'm going to skip all about the collection, but what I think happened in anthropology in relationship to these is that by the early 1980s, there were a series of very, very interesting works about collections and about how they got to where they got to. Douglas Cole's book on Northwest Coast art is a very good example of the kind of insane competition for collection that people like Franz Boas, the father figure of American anthropology, was engaged in. A desire for objects so great that Boas was sneaking out at night and digging up graves and sneaking and sending objects back. But what happened in anthropology in response to this, in response to the critiques, was that attention turned to the history of collecting itself, to the very broad framework in which objects were circulating. That is to say, anthropology's own history and complicity became the subject for anthropological study itself, in which objects were themselves the basis of reanalyzing these histories. And it's the very materiality of these objects that has made it possible for these kinds of histories and analyses to be made. And in saying this, I want to draw attention to, I think, the fundamental property that students of material culture have in one way or another emphasized that make this possible. That is what Nick Thomas called the promiscuity of objects. That is their capacity to be reanalyzed, to be wedded to many different kinds of stories, to have many kinds of marriages. But what Webb Keene has more recently called, drawing on the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, the bundling of properties in objects. That is to say, as Levi-Strauss noted in The Science of the Concrete, any object has more sensible properties to it, more histories, more relationships embedded in it than are ever drawn upon in any single semiotic process, in any installation, in any exhibition, or even in any collector's attention to self-conscious collection to what they're seeing and recording about those objects. And that has made these kinds of histories possible as people turn back to the archives. And ironically, so that in anthropology, which moved into field work, and I think I'm an example of this, and eschewed the museum, now finds the museum and its objects and collections a principal object of our analysis. And it's one of the fundamental changes in anthropology that we see our own knowledge production processes, our own engagements with these objects, as part of what we need to understand itself. There are a number of brilliant exhibitions and books that have been written. I feel that I should mention them in addition to Phillips. And that is, in the U.S., a very significant exhibition that I want to mention, if I can find it very quickly here, is, before I move on, curated by Diane Fain and Ira Jackness and Lisa Breen at the Brooklyn Museum, which they reconsidered their collection around Stuart Kulin's collection of the Southwest. I think it was called Objects of Memory. Sally McClendon recently, but has been working on this for a long time, curated an exhibition of Pomo baskets. Pomo are indigenous people from California, the Mendocino and Sonoma areas. These baskets are considered the high art form of textile work in North America. But by the 1840s, they were already enmeshed in a market that extended to New York, in which particular basket makers were known by name and sought out for their production. In this exhibition that was recently held, The rehistoricizing of these collecting practices has made it very clear that far from being what critics have long said about these kinds of processes of collecting, far from it being theft or appropriation, the trade in these baskets allowed many Pomo to return to the areas in which they were where they had been born, but from which they had been dispersed, and to use the proceeds to buy land, which they turned into the basis for their continued life as an Indian nation. And it's a very compelling and interesting story about the way in which material culture, attention to other people's objects, may enter back into the life world of the people themselves. A brilliant exhibition at the NMAI. Also here at the National Museum, you may not remember, but Luke Taylor curated a brilliant exhibition at the Yarralumla Visitor Center called More Than Meets the Eye, Reflections on the Aboriginal Arts and Crafts Industry. So I thought I would bring back some of your history to you here to show you the promiscuity of these. They've already circulated through New York and into Kirstie's thesis. but this, I think, particularly interesting about that was that Luke saw that the necessity of including, along with the beautiful objects that had been collected, the entire panoply of objects, which now circulate as part of the Aboriginal arts and crafts world and industry, T-shirts and a variety of paraphernalia, made the object of consideration reflexively in the show and the museum itself considered. Now, what I want to say, and the reason that I sort of cut everything else short, is something which I think probably needs to be said by an anthropologist, which is to, and I'm doing this because just the day I left, the conservative critic in the New York Times reviewed a book on cultural property in which he lambasted, as he has wont to do, the concerns of American Indian tribes now about the representation of their works in museums. He particularly hates the National Museum of the American Indian, as do many so-called connoisseurs of Native American art, because they have not focused on exhibition of beautiful objects, although they have many and they do show some, but on making the histories of Native people visible as part of their own history. That is to say, this is an indigenously governed and curated museum, and it has been an object of opprobrium by the former guardians of the aesthetics of Aboriginal art, Native American art. He writes, "The grievous sins of the past are now being repaid with a vengeance, and the risks of repatriation and the requirements of tribal consultation have led to promotional, uninformative, and self-indulgent themes in exhibitions about American Indians." This brings me to the other part, which I think anthropologists have been struggling with around material objects, which is to say, who says this? Who speaks through the museum? Who speaks in the interpretation of these objects? For many things, we speak on behalf of cultures of which we are a part and as members of communities. We know that the what's understood or said about objects can change dramatically depending on the subjectivities of the people who engage these objects. And one of the great changes, I think, in museums, but also in the dealing with material cultural, especially that having to do with indigenous peoples, but with many subaltern peoples, is the recognition of the contested nature and the complexity of what these objects are. So, and I would add to the sensible properties of objects, the memories that people have of them, and the ideas of ownership, cultural and otherwise, which they may have, which have become laudably in many places now part of the exhibition and consideration of these objects. And so let me just then, I think this flows, if I would say, from what many of the other discussants have said so far today, which is a perspective coming from the social life of things, the focus on the biography of objects, really imposes upon us an understanding of the fact that when things flow from one place to another, when they move from the hands of a maker to a museum, they do not give up all the traces of their previous life. They are carried with them. That's something that objects have that can be traced sometimes. And I want to tell you just a very brief story, because I think if you'll recognize this. A couple of years ago, there was a major film festival on called First Nations First Features, in which indigenous filmmakers from around the world came to New York and Washington, D.C., and one of the screening sites was the National Museum of the American Indian. And as part of that, some of the Native people from North America, filmmakers, were asked if they wanted to see collections from their communities. And they went out to the storage areas of the National Museum, which are extensive, and they were they opened up the drawers of these things. And, you know, people broke down in tears when they saw objects which they hadn't seen in their own communities for a generation. Some of them, they actually people recognize them as having been made by relatives of theirs, which have a very different meaning and is part of the property of those objects, which sometimes is recorded and sometimes not, but not, in some cases could be recognized by people. And that is, I think, a compelling part of what these objects bring with them that are not given up. And it's one of the changes. And so for anthropologists, I think we live in a space somewhere between memory and history, in which these objects are often still bearers of the memories of those who have them, as well as the histories that they would tell of them. And I think that my brief was to talk about an anthropologist's perspective that on material objects as sources of inspiration, I think that those of us who have the privilege to be in these spaces, in these times, to watch something about the movement of these objects, to be in conversation with people who have these other relationships to them, many coming from communities in which literacy was not an important part. This is what remains of people's lives, communities, and relationships, and they're not abrogated by the movement of these objects. It's been a great improvement in the treatment of them that in many museums, places have been established in which those relationships can be maintained. And I believe, although maybe some of you will correct me, that many curators have found great inspiration in renewing and re-engaging with those relationships. But it is a major problem, and not to be ignored, that however much we may aspire to producing truth and finding the most empirically satisfying understanding of the sourcing and histories of these objects, there are many, many stories that they carry with them that may not even be truth in a literal sense, but which are part of what they carry with them. And as objects, they seem to be uniquely able to carry a past into a future in this way. And I think that as anthropologists, this is something that we have noted. Our neglect of museums has actually made us now very aware of these as places in which people's memories can live beyond what we can even manage in our own notebooks and in our own writings. Thank you.
Fred, thank you very much. Can I say how much I appreciate your flexibility in responding to the theme of this gathering and for speaking both so passionately and so reflectively. Thank you. I hope that you'll take further part in the proceedings. I think the best thing to do is to ask Fred to take a seat along with the other three speakers and open the discussion up and to direct questions to all of them. So Mike, Guy, Margaret, take your places. Please, the floor's open now for discussion perhaps which connects papers which I think do have a theme running through them. In the middle. Louise. Please hand these.
Thank you very much. Louise Hamby from ANU and the Museums and Collections Program. Fred, I might direct this question to you, but any of the others would be happy to get a response from as well. I was quite interested in your phrase about the space between memory and history. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on how you see that relating to anthropologists and perhaps objects that they have specifically collected.
Well, I suppose, speaking for myself, I am very aware, both of my own memories, that objects I collected for the museum here, for example, that these can be exhibited in many ways. They can be shown as a part of a history of the change in styles of Papunya Tula, changing material dimensions, so on. But they're also, for me, they're connected, and they are in my notes, to a whole series of other things that were going on at the time when those things were happening, but also for many of the participants. And a few years ago at the Papunya Genesis show,
some of the great paintings were exhibited, and Bobby West, whose father was one of the painters who had a show, walked past all the paintings, and he walked right over to his father's painting, and he said, "I'm so proud. That painting was done by my father, and I'm just so proud to see this painting here and to see some part of him as recognized in this way." And I think that that's the space that I'm thinking about here, that whatever many things there are in that painting, for some people, it's what they have left of what they can see of their parents and their fathers, or even memories of the time, because they may recognize something about the way in which things were done. And I think that histories are often more narratively elaborated. Memories are more sporadic. They're personal. They are in different kinds of dialogues with people's lives and so on. And I think I know there's a lot of theorizing on memory and history and different kinds of things, but I think I would try to keep some kind of clarity of the differences of the kinds of meanings that these objects can have for people from communities or who are related to the people, from those that they genuinely have from other perspectives in which we might want to be also working on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. My name's Kirsten Wader. I'm from the National Museum. I actually wanted to pick up on Graham's point a little bit earlier about the relationship between objects and narratives. One of the concepts I've been thinking about a little bit recently is object biography, which, Fred, you used the phrase again, and the biographies of objects. I guess one of the things I'm really interested to think about when we are writing about objects and we, for example, use a practice such as the idea about biography, which I think really has arisen from writing about human lives and which tend to be heavily narrativized, whether how well or in what ways that actually can then be applied or employed to write about objects, which, picking up on some of the things you said, Fred, and other people as well, the idea in which objects seem to almost explode in their interpretive possibilities, and whether that actually is not in conflict with a form of writing that is heavily organised around a practice of narrative, quite linear narrative usually. So in terms of your kind of, I guess, was interested in you reflecting on your own experience about writing about objects, whether that has emerged as a kind of conflict, or what forms of writing and writing practice you've come to use in thinking about objects.
Maybe I shouldn't have used that word. I think once memory and history got used, I was only left with biography. I think some people use biography in a literal sense, especially if they have a very strong sense of objects as agentive. In some way, they may want to see them as kind of willing a kind of history to them. I think the term came out of Arjuna Padarai's The Social Life of Things, when he wanted to talk about, basically you might call it the history of an object, but he was desperately trying to interrupt the gift commodity sense in talking about it. So I think it's a very loose usage. I think there is a narrative style that has been discussed by people of tracking the object. That is one way of telling a story, especially in a situation in which location is not stable, that you can move through a number of what I call regimes of value or a number of contexts by following an object, and it allows you to show contrasts in how. So that I think that's a narrative trope, really, that people can use to show change of meanings, different perspectives that people have. It's all ironic. It has great capacities to illuminate through irony unimagined and unintense relations between people. So I think that is used to recreate the experience that many people have. So for me, I know it didn't always, doesn't, the problem with writing cleverly is it often doesn't work, which means it wasn't very clever. But for me, when I was writing about Punyatula, when I was first there, nobody wanted to buy the paintings. So then it became this hugely important thing, and I wanted to make that irony very powerful. So it works very well to follow things in that way, although sometimes readers don't follow it, so maybe it isn't always a great. But it does carry people along, but I think it could be written a different way. It's not a necessary mode.
Would any other panel member want to chip into that?
Oh. I think in archaeology, object biography is just a convenient term, a metaphor. I don't think we'd be seeing the evidence or the interpretation necessarily constrained by the conventions of literary biography or narrative. Really, it's a way of reconstructing a whole nested set of events, sort of modified and left physical traces on the object. A way of perhaps reconstructing or unpacking an object's history. It has a little more resonance than other more prosaic terms that describe the same process: a reduction sequence, a chain operator. In that way, I would see working out the biography of an object as a tool to get somewhere else, not as necessarily as the end in itself. I think all of the speakers this morning have shown quite an interest in how objects circulate through systems, move, ascribed value, change their function, and so forth, and. In archaeological terms, an object biography is about trying to reconstruct that from the physical traces on the object.
I'd just say that I think when you've given the freedom to write an extended piece, you actually can start to trace out the multiple meanings in an object. I find the real challenge is when you have a 45-word label and the object is sitting in a case, and then the fear is that the meaning can get frozen and perhaps it's a meaning which, you know, might not be the main one or the most important one, and that's even before we get into all the meanings that the audience has when they view the object as well. So that's where I think it's interesting. At least in an extended piece of writing, you have the opportunity to begin to explore the multiple meanings.
Last word, Margie?
Just very briefly, I was going to say that I think we have to be careful to distinguish between narrative, just as telling stories, and linear narrative. And I hope we're not all being constrained by the former Prime Minister's view of writing history as narratives. I don't think that's what we mean or are talking about here. Yeah.
Good-o. Thank you. That's the end of the session. Look, this session, I think, has delivered exactly what we had hoped. Our speakers have reminded us of the foundation disciplines and the essential ideas and debates as a basis for the discussion that will continue after morning tea and throughout the day.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.